March of Time. This week's news fronts of the world brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine.
The Japanese enemy.
The first captured diary of a Japanese soldier who died on Saipan.
Science.
For the first time in science, the sounds made by disease-bearing mosquitoes hitherto unheard by the human ear.
The home front.
How are mothers of American soldiers in Europe feel about their fighting in the Far East?
New facts about cancer.
17 million Americans now living may die from cancer. Stand by for this week's news fronts of the world, brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine, on
The March of Time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Westbrook Van Voorhis speaking for the editors of Time magazine. Tonight, for the first time on the air, the most unusual scientific news of the week. Announcement has just been made that for the first time, the sounds made by mosquitoes, inaudible to the human ear, have been recorded. These novel experiments have been carried on for almost a year by Dr. Morton C. Kahn, Associate Professor of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Cornell University Medical College, in association with William Offenhauser and William Celliston. Tonight, Dr. Kahn is in the March of Time's New York studio to demonstrate some of the recordings of mosquitoes he and his associates have made. And here is how Dr. Kahn describes his work.
It is important that mosquitoes be destroyed because they transmit dangerous diseases such as malaria, yellow fever, and dengue fever. The methods of destroying mosquitoes hitherto in use are very efficient but cannot always be used. So in looking for additional methods of mosquito destruction, it occurred to us that mosquitoes might have characteristic mating calls or other sounds. We learned that this is true. Using special equipment, we have now made some 90 records of the sounds made by different breeds of mosquitoes. These sounds cannot be heard by human ears, and so we had to amplify them more than 100 million times. We have learned several things about mosquitoes from studying these recordings. Mosquitoes seem to make three kinds of sounds: mating calls, warnings of danger, and calls of anger. We observed, too, that the sounds made by male mosquitoes are more high-pitched than the females. The sounds are made while the mosquitoes are in flight or at rest, but in many instances, we are not always exactly sure how they're made. The most important thing we have learned is that mosquitoes of one breed respond to the sounds made by other mosquitoes of the same breed. The noise of a single female, as you will hear in a moment, causes the males of the same species to burst into an answering chorus. But a mosquito of one species will not respond to a call from another species. They operate, as it were, on different wavelengths. The fact that mosquitoes of the same species respond to each other, even though no two are exactly alike, leads us to believe that we will be able to broadcast their own mating calls to mosquito breeding grounds and in that way attract them to us for destruction. In other words, we have the beginnings of a mosquito trap. And in the next few months, we're going to carry out extensive field experiments. Now you will hear some of the recordings we have made. First, here is the mating call of a single female mosquito of the species Anopheles quadrimaculatus, the chief transmitter of malaria in the United States. Now here she is, amplified more than 100 million times. When we recorded that sound and played it back to a cage containing some 25 male mosquitoes of the same breed, we got an astonishing result. Now you will hear the single female mating call again. Then a silence of a few seconds while the males take a moment to make up their minds. This is the actual time it took for the 25 males to respond. Now you'll hear their actual response. Now you will hear the response of two single male Anopheles to a recording of a female call. And now for the so-called chicken call. It doesn't sound exactly like a chicken, but there is a resemblance. Another interesting and important point we learned is that the sounds produced by each species are all quite different. You have just heard the anopheles. Now here is the response of a single male of the species Aedes aegypti, which transmits dengue fever in the southern parts of this country and yellow fever in other regions of the world. He sounds rather like a quail or a partridge. Now, here is the response of a single male of the species Aedes albopictus. This mosquito comes from Asia and transmits dengue fever there. It is also a potential transmitter of yellow fever. The mechanical noise you hear is not a defect in your radio. That is made by the insect itself. Mating calls, however, are not the only sounds that mosquitoes make. From long observation, we are inclined to believe that mosquitoes have a strong sense of fellowship with each other. When one is in danger, he not only becomes angry himself, but makes loud noises to warn his comrades. To test that idea, we angered one mosquito by wetting him. Here is the sound he made. There is still a great deal we do not know about mosquito sounds, but we feel we have made a beginning in a direction that may ultimately lead to the more efficient destruction of mosquitoes, one of mankind's worst enemies among the insects.
Time marches on. Published today, the current issue of Time magazine tells for the first time the story of a Japanese soldier's diary. Taruo Kawaguchi was sent to Saipan early last June. During some 30 days while U.S. forces invaded the island, he kept a diary. Found by an American officer after the island fell, this diary reveals how Japs, fighting rat-like for every island fortress in the Pacific, lived their last day and die. Here are excerpts from the diary of Japanese soldier Taruo Kawaguchi.
June 14th.
Today, we transferred to the air raid shelter on the left side of the valley. On this day, the enemy landed, and the time has come at last.
June 26th.
Spent the night below the caves with some wounded men. Some of them were committing suicide with hand grenades.
June 30th.
Ate rice for the first time in 5 days and regained strength.
July 5th.
Lieutenant Matsumae came to our dugout saying,
"As long as I'm going to die, I want to die with this section. If this is going to be our grave, let us make it clean."
July 6th.
Took cover in the rocks. When I looked from the side of the rock, I could see the hateful, bearded face of the enemy shining in the sunlight. With a terrific report, the rock in front of my eyes exploded. Corporal Yasuhiro had wounds in both of his legs. Pathetically, he was saying,
"Please, kill me. Please, kill me."
So Lieutenant Matsumae took a sword. The corporal pleaded,
"Please cut skillfully. Cut skillfully."
The lieutenant, with sweat pouring down his head, took one stroke.
Ach.
Two strokes. And on the third stroke, he cut his head off. Orders to move were issued. Facing the dawn of the north, bowing reverently to the imperial palace and bidding farewell to the parents, wife, aunt, I solemnly pledged to do my utmost. But the enemy is surrounding us on all sides. So, with the determination of dying for the emperor, we passed our time by preparing our remembrances. I am only 26 years old. Thanks to the emperor, both my parents and my aunt, I have lived to this day, and I am deeply gratified. At the same time, it is with deep regret that I have nothing to report at this time when my life is fluttering away like a flower petal to become part of the soil. I, with my sacrificed body, will become the Whitecaps of the Pacific and will stay on this island until the friendly forces of the Emperor come to reclaim the soil of the Emperor.
The next day, Corporal Taruo Kawaguchi died, as he expected, and became one of the Whitecaps of the Pacific. Such is our Japanese enemy, who can write pretty sentiments in a diary, yet fight and die more like an animal than a man. Time marches on! This week, Time magazine publishes the first account generally available to the public of new army treatments for psychoneurotic soldiers. They've been carried on for the past 6 months by Major Albert A. Rosner, Medical Corps, Army of the United States. Major Rosner's technique? With full knowledge of his patients, he turns on a regular Army office recording machine, gets the words and tone of each interview for his case records. Tonight, the March of Time brings you the verbatim reports of some of the interviews held by Major Rosner. Only the patients' names have been changed. These cases, selected from many already recorded by Major Rosner, are all of soldiers who cracked up mentally and emotionally, not in combat, but while still in this country. Their illness is a symptom of subconscious protest against conditions to which they could not adjust themselves. In explaining his methods, says Major Rosner,
usually the psychiatrist's only means of studying an interview after it's completed is from notes, or at best a written transcript. These do not convey what is often the most important element in a psychiatric interview, the tones of voice and the emotions of the patient. Psychiatric recording meets this problem. Now, here is the case of a simple, honest, homey individual with an intense love for his farm. He was a conscientious, plodding soldier, but he had difficulty with the manual of arms and in learning regulations. Terribly worried about his farm, he had become nervously and emotionally upset and had tried to commit suicide by drinking iodine. This is how my interview went with him. Bill, I want you to tell me what it was that brought you to the hospital about a week ago.
Well, sir, they said I drank iodine.
Did you take iodine?
I don't know, sir. I don't know. I don't understand it.
Have you been having a pretty tough time of it in the Army?
Well, sir, I have, yeah.
What's been the trouble?
I've been getting headaches.
Headaches? And have you been worried about something?
Well, sir, I was worried about the farm. They need me there, sir.
And you've been concerned about the chickens, too.
Yes, sir, I have.
The other day, you became all upset about one of the ward boys and chickens. Do you remember? You were listening to some music, I think, at the time.
Oh, about the records, sir?
Yes, tell me about that.
Oh, well, them records, I can't understand them, sir. I don't know. They just boom, boom all day long, sir.
Are they jazz records?
I don't know what kind of records they are. I never heard records like them before.
Well, are they symphony records?
Yes, sir. I think that's what you call them. They go boom, boom all day long.
Have you heard records like that before?
No, sir. I don't like them.
What about the rooster?
Oh, the rooster. Well, I can't understand the rooster crowing at night here. I never heard that before.
Well, why did you get so upset the other day?
Well, they wouldn't let me go over to see the chickens.
But finally, Bill did see his chickens. Major Rosner recommended medical discharge for Bill, permitting him to return to his farm and a solution to his emotional difficulty. Next case.
Buck was an excellent soldier, but when he was given the usual series of inoculations before being sent overseas, he was brought to me for a psychiatric interview. This is how it went. Now, what's your trouble, Buck? How long have you been in the hospital?
I don't know how long I've been here. They give me shots and my whole body got paralyzed. I've been paralyzed ever since.
Well, tell me more about it.
Well, I'm weak.
Why do you breathe so heavily? Are you out of breath?
Oh, no, I'm just weak.
You seem to be pretty upset about something.
I'm all right.
Why can't you walk?
My legs won't hold me. I fall.
Do you sleep all right at night?
No, sir. I don't know why. I just can't breathe.
How long have you been in the Army, Buck?
Oh, about 2 years. Never been in the hospital before. They gave me shots the other day and I've become stiff all over.
Buck was suffering from hysteria. Major Rosner treated him with sedatives, discussed his case thoroughly with him, made him realize his legs were not really paralyzed as he thought. Buck was cured in 24 hours. Next case.
Fred, a 20-year-old sergeant, was brought to the hospital from a downtown cafe. He had suddenly felt dizzy and had fallen down. At first, he was considered epileptic. The next day, however, he was fully alert and requested to be returned immediately to his group. He was released from the hospital, but in a few hours returned, stating that he was unable to remain on duty. He appeared to be in an acutely agitated condition. During a long interview, I finally asked him if he was afraid.
Yes, sir. I am now.
Of what?
Going overseas.
As the interview progressed, Fred became more and more agitated. I asked him, what's the trouble, Fred? Why are you upset? Tell me, Fred, why are you so upset?
I just want my wife. I want my wife. Where is she? I want her here.
Would you care to see her in your present state?
I want her here. I want her here.
Have you been crying a great deal the last few days?
No, sir. Not very much.
Did you ever cry like this before in your life?
No, sir. I never have.
This is new to you.
Yes, sir, it is.
What makes you worry about your family so?
I just don't want to go overseas.
Well, why is that? Can you tell me?
I don't want to go over, that's all. I'm scared. I'm nervous.
Well, if we can get you over this feeling, do you think you can make a go of it?
I want to do my part.
Major Rosner's treatment of Sergeant Fred, personal discussion to make him realize that anxiety over the coming separation from his wife was the underlying cause of his upset condition. The cure? Return to his former army station and reunion with his wife. Recently, Major Rosner's recordings of psychiatric interviews were demonstrated before members of New York's Neurological Society and aroused keen interest in Major Rosner's methods for civilian use after the war. An important help to a world at peace again. Time marches on. This week, Americans on the home front were tensely waiting for the news as it poured out of Adolf Hitler's ex-fortress, Europe. They, along with the fighting men who were making that news, had one feeling in common. A feeling expressed by Time correspondent Harry Zinder. Reporting to his editors from headquarters of the swiftly moving British Second Army, Zinder said,
if there was ever a time for optimism, this is it.
Yes, there can be no doubt this time that Americans here at home have a real right to be optimistic. And yet, here is an interesting fact. While all Americans know that the Allied armies are pressing for a quick victory, many are confused, and naturally so, about just what is going on. The swiftness of the war's movement, the frequent news blackouts, the fluidity of the fronts. These and many other factors make it hard to understand what is happening now and what is likely to happen next. It is during periods like this that Time magazine performs especially valuable service for its readers. For Time tells the story of the war and of all the world's important events as one straight connected story that is easy to follow and understand. For instance, Time has 5 correspondents with our advancing armies in Germany. But their daily reports to Times editors are only the beginning of Times' job of reporting the war to you. For Times editors carefully weigh these reports, check them against the bulletins of the Associated Press, consider them along with all available facts from many other sources. And only then do they write into the magazine their balanced, informed, swift-moving account of the news. That is a big reason why each week more than 1 million American families who want to keep abreast of world history while it is being made turn to the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine. With victory in Europe somewhere around the corner, to the mothers, wives, and sweethearts of 3,500,000 U.S. fighting men in Europe, the biggest question is, when will Johnny come marching home? You can't help dreaming that some other mother's son has got to help occupy Germany or ship directly to the Pacific, and hoping that yours is the lucky one to get home, at least for a furlough on the way to Tokyo. A few days ago in Indianapolis, Time magazine correspondent E.C. Heinke set out to find what the mothers of boys in Europe thought about the matter. So he went to a meeting of the local chapter of the American War Mothers. Afterward, he explained what he was after to a group of them, including Mrs. Thelma Prather, president of the chapter.
Well, of course, Mr. Heinke, there's been a lot of worry and uneasiness about whether our boys who are fighting in Germany are going to get home. or whether they've got to be shipped straight to the Pacific.
That's right.
That's what worries me.
Well, Mrs. Crowther, your own son Jack is home now on furlough, isn't he?
Yes, after 30 months in Africa. I think any man who's been across 2 years or more is entitled to a 6 months furlough at least.
How does Jack feel about it?
Oh, it isn't worrying him. I hope he doesn't have to go. But he's not only willing to go, he'd be proud. But Mrs. Wicker here has 3 sons overseas.
Yes. First, there's Vincent. He's been overseas 28 months. He's in France.
Really?
I feel he's been over long enough and that he's done enough. Then there's Maxwell. He's been in the Pacific 15 months already. Oh, I think the boys who've been overseas should come home permanently instead of going to the Pacific.
But the government says it needs men trained in fighting, Mrs. Wicker.
Well, training in European warfare is different from that required in the Pacific. I don't want to hinder the progress of the war in the Pacific, but I do feel there are enough trained men in the United States who've never seen any fighting.
Mrs. Wicker has a 3rd son overseas, Mr. Hank.
Yes. Richard has been missing 11 months.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mrs. Russell, I believe you have 3 sons overseas.
Yes, Mr. Heinke. Basil's been in Europe 18 months. Hugh in the Pacific for 4 years. He's been home just 4 days and 4 hours in all those 4 years.
Mm.
And John's in a hospital in England after fighting in Germany.
How do you feel about this?
Well, my 3 boys have done a pretty good job in helping to keep our enemies away from our shores. And now I just feel that it's somebody else's turn. But if my boys have to go to the Pacific, it'll be all right. I'll just try to keep my chin up.
4 years is a long time. How do you feel about this, Mrs. Brandenburg?
Well, my son's been in Europe just 6 months, so I don't think he ought to be favored. I think he should stay over a reasonable length of time, say 2 years, and then be allowed to come home.
Well, that certainly seems...
Mr. Heinke...
Yes, Mrs. Pratt.
There's been a lot of worry and uneasiness. All of us want to see our loved ones come home, at least for a good long furlough. And if it's possible, let somebody else do the fighting in the Pacific. But of course, none of us want to do anything to slow up the war in the Pacific. If the boys don't get back, at least for furloughs, well, we'll be disappointed, but we'll follow orders and do our best.
Are you doing anything about it or planning to do anything?
Oh, some of us are going to write somebody in Washington and try to tell them. We're trying to find out the proper party to write to, the government or our congressman.
Indianapolis mothers are very probably a fair sample of all the mothers of America. They want their boys home, but if they're sent to the Pacific, chins will still be up. At most, they plan to exercise an American's inalienable right to write to his congressman. This month, the American people have reason to study a grim casualty list. It is not the casualty list of World War II. It is the number of deaths from a disease growing yearly until it is now the nation's second worst killer after heart ailments. It is cancer.
Cancer will kill 175,000 U.S. citizens this year.
In the first 3 years of war, the number of Americans killed in battle or to die of wounds was less than the number of cancer deaths in any one of those years.
Cancer kills more children than polio. Babies are born with cancer.
Every year, the cancer death rate goes up. People saved from other diseases by medical miracles like plasma, sulfa, and penicillin live long enough to die of cancer.
1 in every 8 Americans dies of cancer. If this rate continues, 17 million Americans living today will die of cancer.
That is why cancer is more of a practical problem than ever before. That is why this month, Cancer Control Month, the American Cancer Society has launched on its first decently ambitious money-raising drive. The goal, $5 million for the purposes of education, prevention, and research. Education is sorely needed for a U.S. public woefully ignorant of the number 2 cause of death.
One U.S. citizen in five still thinks cancer is contagious.
Cancer is neither contagious nor infectious.
One in four still thinks cancer is incurable.
Caught early, cancer is generally the most curable of all major causes of death. But relatively few early cancers get any treatment. Take the case of Mrs. X from the records of the American Cancer Society. Mrs. X is 35. She felt no pain, but she did have a small lump on her breast. Mrs. X went to her family doctor.
Tell me, Emily, how long have you noticed this lump?
Oh, perhaps 2 weeks. Why, doctor? It's nothing serious, is it?
Might be serious if we left it in. Won't be if we take it out. If you're right about that 2 weeks.
You mean it's cancer?
Now, Emily, some of them are, say, have, and some of them aren't. That's my experience.
Mrs. X's small lump was cut out by surgery. Pathological tests showed it was malignant, but Mrs. X was out of the hospital in a few days, cured. But take the case of Mrs. Y. She was also 35, and she had a larger lump on her breast.
How long have you had this lump, Mrs.?
Oh, doctor, I've been so worried about it. So afraid. My husband wanted me to come to you a year ago.
A year ago?
Yes.
But why were you afraid?
I was afraid it was cancer. A friend of mine had
the
same...
You were afraid it was cancer, so you did nothing. You had everything to gain by coming, everything to lose by staying away. Well, we'll see what we can do.
Later, the doctor talked with Mr. Y.
Cancers are curable, Sam, but only if they're eliminated by early treatment.
I tried to get her to come to you, doctor.
I know, and we did what we could. We cut it out. But you've got to remove every last abnormal cell, because a new cancer can spring from one remaining cell. When they get away from us, there's nothing we can do.
But can't you cut the others out, too?
They migrate, Sam. We call it to metastasize. That is cancer's real malignancy. When it invades vital organs, it kills. Sometimes it starves its victim to death. Sometimes it strangles. X-rays show your wife's cancer has reached her lungs.
Some 6 million, or one-third of those Americans doomed to cancer, can be cured by methods medicine already knows. By surgery, by X-rays, by hormone regulation. Perhaps up to one-half could be saved by seeing their doctor now. And the other half of the 17 million Americans? That depends on new methods, new research, new developments. How soon these are discovered may well depend on financial support of the U.S. public. Over recent years, for polio research, about 500 per polio death has become available. For cancer, $5. What is needed is emphatically not a cut in polio funds, but an increase in cancer research funds. Tonight, Mr. Eric Johnston, chairman of the Executive Council of the American Cancer Society, has sent the following message to the March of Time audience.
To attack this gigantic problem, the American people have been contributing less than $1 million annually. This is a pitifully small sum to devote to the control of this dread disease. This year, the American Cancer Society is asking for $5 million to finance the first really comprehensive attack on cancer, meeting three vital needs: education to make people act in time, service to cancer patients, and provision of a truly adequate program of research. This is a fight in which we all have a stake. Cancer is almost certain, if it does not attack us directly, to cause the death of someone dear to us. By giving to the Society's great new program, we are helping literally as well as figuratively to guard those we love.
Time marches on.
Over the same network every afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern Wartime, listen to Time Views the News, another program prepared by the editors and correspondents of Time magazine. And next Thursday evening at the same time, listen again to the March of Time.
This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.